thank you so much, Kimberly. That was absolutely splendid. I just want to sit here and just think about some things for a while, but we have to press on in a more expressive way with the ideas you've sown so beautifully. I really appreciate the very, well, I'm going to use the word positive, view of human evolution and the capacity to grow and change. Related to that is the fact that we have a group discussion coming up now, and you have a few guidelines in your packets. It seemed to me that you made a very interesting point, and some of you may want to comment on this too, Kimberly, when you said that you spoke of the relentless, virulent critique which undermines and exhausts the will to good, and that absolutely registers with me. We are much less skilled, you said, in the art of strengthening. And the focus of our meditation, of course, is strengthening the hands of the new group of world servers. I suppose that's been bothering a lot of us as we've watched the way we conduct democracy in this country and the not only the messiness of it, but the meanness of it. And I'm amazed that we get two people left standing willing to endure what they go through. Honestly, God bless them both. Regardless of who you're going to vote for, I don't know how they endure it or the people who care for them can stand it. And that relates to question five, I thought. What are the major obstacles to democracy today? Capitalism, the two-party system, indifference, the media, governments, the endless criticism of the concrete-minded? Kimberly has the microphone, and you also, via Daniel, have the microphone. We don't need to work our way through these questions in a linear way, but they're meant to kind of focus our group discussion. Anyone? Paul?
It seems that these two presentations and discussions that have been offered today point to when crisis occurs that there is a death, a recoiling, and as we face this, you know, the criticism comes from the fear of what we're going to do, and we want to identify that quickly, and in so doing, the criticism shames people in the process, whether it's the doers or the perceivers, and it seems that this is kind of a human trait, but if what's the antithesis of that fear? Is it hope, and is that the same as optimism? And how real an ingredient is that, spiritually speaking, in terms of how do we let go of what is dying, the past forms that no longer serve the present, if we can release them without that attachment, then maybe there's less criticism, mm-hmm. which allows us to embrace that opportunity.
Kimberly may want to respond. Some of you may want to respond. Marilyn, you had your hand up. Yes.
I just wanted to say that in a certain way, all of these obstacles can be related to fear, and that we know that in humanity today, there's a great deal of fear that we all have to deal with. I mean, you know, if you're afraid that you're not going to have enough for your family, you don't want to share. You can't share. And if you're afraid that if you put out goodwill, you may get hit in the face, you're not going to want to do goodwill. If you're afraid and can't trust people who have been corrupt, and those people who have been corrupt are scared to death, they're not going to have place in the world if they're not being corrupt and stealing everything, so they come off being big guns, and underneath they know they really aren't. So they're fearful of that, so then general public doesn't trust them. If you live in an environment where you're afraid of speaking out because you may go to jail or be decapitated or some other thing, you can't very well back up freedom. So all of these things are major obstacles, but a lot of it is based on fear. And I know that I heard somebody even say that in the case of Iran, that the people are terrified. And if we were able to somehow dispel some of that fear, we might be able to come come to some kind of negotiation with them. And I think this is true of so many places in the world where people really live under a regime of fear. And even now, in our own country, people are scared to death because of the economic problems and the wars and everything. People are living under a lot of fear. And if we could begin to break that by bringing in more a sense of goodwill and love, even on a very small level in our own areas, as Sarah was saying, in our own workplaces, whatever, if we can start building a sense of love pouring into the environment, which leads to a sense of joy within everyone around you, that eventually this might help to disperse some of the fear.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Yeah, Robert, you haven't had a chance today.
Thank you, Sarah. The fifth question, what are the major obstacles to democracy today? I think all of them are obstacles to democracy, and I think what hits my mind first is the two-party system, because from what I see and from just discussions that I've heard and people I know who are involved in opposite parties, Democrat and Republican, so much energy is spent undermining each other, and I fail to see how when people are Democrats or Republican, that they more or less close the wall. The wall comes down, and it's as though on the Democrats' side, it's the opinion that the Republicans have never done anything right, and anything that was good is more or less not acknowledged, or the Democrat will go into denial. And the same is true for the Republican. When I went upstate and I went to the Franklin Delano Roosevelt home, and I became more aware of all the good, and of course I knew it from the history books, but there's nothing that can impact one more than going up to the Franklin Delano Roosevelt home and Eleanor Roosevelt's home. And when I really thought about what he had done, and then sometimes I'll talk to Republicans, and it's just a complete denial that he's done anything worthwhile, and even something like Social Security, which really keeps the elderly on their feet and during good or bad economic times, even that's denied, and they'll find holes in it and weaknesses, and well, that comes out of our tax money, and we're all paying for them, and so on and so forth. So I see the two-party system where we have this duality created where people are fighting each other. I think it's so defeating to democracy, and there's so much corruption that comes from it. I would think that a one-party system might be better.
Mm-hmm. So that's just polarizing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So polarizing. The parliamentary system, like in Israel, where Zippy Livni had to try to put together a coalition, she failed. But just imagine anybody even trying to do that in this country, a coalition of Republicans and Democrats. It's hard to imagine with what you're saying. Kimberly, if you want, I can't always see you out of the sun, right? Just let me know if you want to speak up. Sharon.
Yeah, thank you. The thought crossed my mind while you were going through the history of the astrological implications. And knowing that we're going from the age of Pisces into we're receiving the Aquarian age energy, it's intriguing to think of the different events that you delineated and trying to imagine, or maybe even go back at some point to see what the planetary influences or the cosmic energies were at that particular time. But today we have Pluto is entering Capricorn, which is an upheaval of all kinds of structures. We've got Saturn in Virgo, which is opposing Uranus, the big revolutionary. So there's this upheaval, and I'm also reminded that this was the year that we had the two Wesaks.
Two Taurus full moons, one Wesak.
I'm sorry, yeah. That the two Taurus full moons, which I remember, Sarah, you pointing out that the last time that happened.
1989, when, we had the Tiananmen Square riots followed in the lower interlude of the year, right about now, the opening up of Eastern Europe, which is just astonishing. I have a whole packet of information on it. Every morning you'd get up and turn on the radio and some country had overthrown its system. Hungary, Romania, Czechoslovakia then. It went on and on. Remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I guess the last point that I wanted to bring out is with this Aquarian energy, there seems to be sort of a subculture around the planet of small groups working together.
Subculture? You said?
There's something that's not necessarily making mainstream media, and we're still looking for that one person to come and save us, but underneath that, there's these groups that are all interconnected, very small groups. I think it was in a World Goodwill recent edition.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So, another slant on democracy.
Yes, Daniel, right in front of you, yes.
Oh, thank you. What I was thinking is that I think there is a relation between the individual and what we call democracy. In other words, how the group, if a nation is a group, for example, expresses my interest as a person. When we mention fear or we mention freedom, are very individual worries that we have. We want to be free, we don't want to have fear, for example, even though we do have fears, and sometimes we don't have freedom. But historically, how, for example, in the actual election, when we talk about choices, McCain or Obama, they choose to be president. No one really president. You have to be president, McCain or Obama. They just decide to be president. It's with freedom, they decide to do it. The same thing we'll say, for example, of Hitler. You know, we go back in history, or any king in the medieval, they make a choice. You know, I want power, and when I have power, I want to do what I want to do. So choices doesn't mean always that you have something right. I mean, no? You can have a choice to do something wrong. For example, probably what McCain wants to do with the country is different from what Obama wants to do for the country. You know, so my question is about what do you think about choices? You know, considering these aspects that I mentioned.
One of the things I was I hope this bears on your point, but I was thinking when I was thinking about human rights, one of the problems that comes up is sort of an ethical problem, which is generally that it seems to me most people don't seek to do wrong or good. They see the good in different ways. And I think maybe this is a little bit what you're talking about with these choices. It's not like there's one wrong way and one right way. An ethics question that comes up that has to do with, say, killing someone. If someone is about to kill someone, would you kill them in order to prevent this? Or would you say, no, under no circumstances do we ever kill anyone? How do you see those two things? They're both one way of conceiving of the good and the other way of conceiving of the good. And I think this is where often for reflective people it can become very confusing, very difficult to know how to make the right choice. I think one thing we can do is try, at least individually and in conversation, to try to encourage a more well-rounded thought process about every problem that we have. And to me, this is where the civility comes in, is learning to be calm enough and civil enough to just let people go through all the possible scenarios you could have on any given choice, and just let it settle for a little while too, instead of feeling this need to be right, to have a right answer immediately. Most of the serious problems facing humanity are extremely complicated. If they weren't, we would have found solutions to them right now. I'm always amazed when I hear people talk politically as if, you know, if we only did it this and this and this, you know, if it were that easy, surely we would be doing it that way. It's combining all the many complicated things that go into make life, going up to make what life is. So, you know, I think the only thing we can do is to try to do what we can to encourage that atmosphere in which people feel safe to say what they think, to voice ideas that you may want to throw out without having that stigmatize you. You know, maybe you said something that wasn't correct, but you could move on. And I worry a lot about the breakdown of this and the need for real repair on a daily basis. And we all come in contact with people on a daily basis, I think, in which this work can be done, where you really set an example and set a tone of exploration of ideas and exploration of thought and bringing in many, many ideas. And this is the only way we're ever going to come to a solution to the problems before us.
Well said, and I like your touching on the need to be right. I think if we could give up that need, we would find ourselves liberated, wouldn't we? I've been just pondering on what that would mean for my life. I don't know about you. Just give up the need to be right. Susan, last comment. You can have the final word.
Oh, well, that brings up the